Hi, this is Corey Olson, the Tolkien Professor, and welcome to another episode of the Silmarillion Seminar.
Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Jason Jewell speaking, and you're about to listen to the first of three discussions on the tale of Beren and Lúthien. The seminar participants have given this episode the ironical title, Father of the Year, because of the less-than-stellar behavior of Thingol, the ruler of the Elf Kingdom of Doriath, towards his would-be son-in-law Beren and his daughter Lúthien. Most of us, with the exception of yours truly, jump onto a Thingol-bashing dog pile about two-thirds of the way through the episode. I actually attempt to defend Thingol, arguing that his past accomplishments and the difficulty of his present circumstances mitigate his conduct. This line of defense is the same as that used by the Plataeans about themselves when they surrendered to the Spartans during the Peloponnesian War, and its effectiveness can be seen in that shortly after the Plataeans made it, the Spartans executed them all. As you'll soon hear, my defense of Thingol wasn't much more successful. In this episode, you'll also hear a detailed discussion about the various forms of bondage present in the tale and the ways people are released from it, as well as a number of comments on the dangers of taking oaths in Tolkien's world. We hope you enjoy Father of the Year.
And I'll have you know, I was this close to forgetting to push the record button tonight. I just pushed it as you started talking, so that was pretty close. Anyway, but it's on now. Okay, no problems.
You want to start again?
Nah, I didn't say anything important. It's okay, go ahead.
Okay. As I was reading the story, I was struck again by the fact that there's so many elements of different things in the story. You know, there's the thing with, you know, when she escapes and she lets down her hair, that reminds you of Rapunzel, and there's some things that remind you of the Icelandic sagas, and it just made me think of that part of On Fairy Stories where he talks about fairy stories as being like a soup, and I wanted to read some of it. So in regard to fairy stories, I feel that it is more interesting and also in its way more difficult to consider what they are, what they have become for us, and what values the long alchemic processes of time have produced in them. In Dasein's words, I would say, we must be satisfied with the soup that is set before us and not desire to see the bones of the ox out of which it has been boiled. And he goes on for a little bit, and the last thing he says, but I do not, of course, forbid criticism of the soup as soup. So he's saying, it's tempting to sort of piece things apart and see where they all come from, but, you know, as a whole, it's something completely different than the sum of its parts. It's not just, you know, oh, he took Rapunzel and he took, you know, these other sagas and he twisted them around. That's not the point. The point is it becomes something completely new.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I do think that that is the big temptation. The big temptation is to, you know, as he says, to try to identify the bones of the ox. When you notice things, especially when there are those moments which seem, you know, these really clear echoes, as you say, the Rapunzel moment, is certainly the one that also jumps out at me, in this part of the story, as being so clear. But, you know, the problem, I think, you know, that we have to keep in mind in, as readers, the temptation to resist, as Tolkien is talking about there, is basically feeling like observing that intrinsically helps us understand the story better, because it doesn't necessarily. You know, I mean, like, okay, so Lúthien letting down her hair is like Rapunzel letting down her hair. What insight actually does that give us into the story of Lúthien? Clearly, Rapunzel is in the soup. And it's interesting to think in connection to Rapunzel, and we can do some, you know, one, I don't think we'll have time tonight, but we could do some comparison and contrast with various versions of the Rapunzel story, and we can see some of the ways in which it seems to be operating and some of the things that Tolkien seems to be appealing to. You can do some interesting kind of analysis, but the problem seems to be that when people identify stuff like that, there's often this impulse to be like, ah, now I see through this, right? This moment with Lúthien is the Rapunzel element. And in saying that, you stop thinking about what's happening with Lúthien at that moment. And of course, in the context of this story, the moment when she lets down her hair is, you know, one illustration out of several of how we see, I mean, two of the things which are really emphasized about Luthien are her voice and her hair. You know, her hair is also what is sort of serves as a cloak around her to conceal her as she's traveling and everything. So we see that, you know, it's and that doesn't happen with Rapunzel. So we see that this element, this Rapunzel element, has been incorporated, has been, I almost said digested, which kind of reverses the analogy, but anyway, has been acclimated into the stew. And it's now a different thing. It is now its own soup. It's not it's not just this piece that you can pick out anymore. Dave?
You kind of already stole my thunder, but I was going to say that, I mean, on the other hand, you don't want to just toss it out like, well, Tolkien has forbidden us to draw analogies, so we're just going to pretend that this isn't almost exactly the same sort of narrative elements as the Rapunzel story has here. I mean, come on, it's like, it's almost exactly the same sort of thing going on. And I agree that, like, to stop there and say, well, it's a Rapunzel story element, and then move and then keep and then not push any further. But there's got to be some value in saying why he had to have been aware that he was doing something that was very similar to Rapunzel. And so obviously he made a conscious choice to write it that way. And I wonder why. And maybe he's trying to elicit some of the same some of the same sort of elements and themes and ideas and imagery that he got when he first read or encountered the Rapunzel story, maybe. I don't know. I'm sort of playing devil's advocate here.
Yeah, sure. No, and I think, I mean, you're right. It certainly is fruitful to think about. My only argument would just be that we need to think about it. So you think about the Rapunzel story, for instance, and I'm thinking, of course, of the Andrew Lang version of the Rapunzel story, which is freshest in my mind because I just did it in my fairy and fantasy class, and there, Rapunzel letting down her hair does seem to be in some sense magical, though it's not obvious that magic is entirely under her control. She is essentially the prisoner of a witch when she's letting down her hair. And she's letting down her hair at the command of the witch herself. I mean, she's essentially the servant. You know, she's being made the stepladder or the rope ladder or whatever of the witch. And, you know, when the prince oversees this one day, he calls out for her to let down her hair, and then he climbs up, and it's not initially at all really a rescue thing. It's just, you know, he comes up to visit her and is like, hey, here I am climbing up your hair. So we have the Rapunzel character, although there is magic associated with her, she is almost an entirely passive character, in the Andrew Lang story. And of course it's therefore to me really interesting that we get that Rapunzel element with Luthien at the moment when she is, you know, when she begins to be, for the first time in the story, very active and very autonomous. She, too, is being held prisoner up in a treehouse prison, essentially. But instead of just being held there as a slave and only letting down her hair to let her captor in, you know, to let her captor come in and out, essentially, instead she uses her hair to let herself out and to set herself free. Just as she uses her hair again, you know, very soon after that to conceal herself, as I said. So I mean, even that one difference by itself, and then of course you think about the difference between the relationship between Luthien and her, prince male interest, and Rapunzel and hers. Again, Rapunzel does nothing like, breaking herself out of prison and then going to break him out of prison and making Sauron, you know, sit up and cry for mommy. So anyway, it's really different in those ways. But of course, those differences are I think really emphasized by that connection. So I think it does more than just establish differences, but certainly when you start to think about it and you start to unpack it, I think that it's I think it gets really interesting. And this is the kind of thing that I think is most productive to do. You know, when you really put the stories next to each other and you begin to see how is this moment really functioning in this story, what are some ways in which it's building off of these other ideas, in which it's moving away from them. I think it's pretty cool. So good. Well, let's Let's move on to section one. Our first topic today is the title. The title of the episode, the title of, well, not the episode, the title of the chapter. Or we're told, rather, not of Beren and Luthien, that's pretty straightforward, but we're told that this chapter is derived from a song which is called the Lay of Lathian, which is translated as Release from Bondage. Now, thoughts on Release from Bondage. Brandon, I think, do you have audio tonight, Brandon? It seems Brandon's audio is not working tonight, so I'll just read the question that Brandon asks, because he asks, you know, some very good questions, I think, to start this off here. What kind of bondage is being referred to in Release from Bondage? He says, bondage is basically suffering. Is this a release from suffering? Can what appears to be a tragedy really be eucatastrophic? Is there eucatastrophe involved here? That part of the question will probably we'll save until next time. We're not going to get to the very end of the story. So, you know, trying to discuss, is this ultimately a tragedy, or is there a eucatastrophe? How do we understand that? We'll of course, talk about that primarily next week. And also he goes on to say, it seems like the real release from bondage is the marriage of elves and men. And I think that that's, you know, I want to come back to that in a minute, though. Again, the actual marriage, the actual union between the two of them, we don't yet really see. We see their bond together, to take the word bondage in a different sense. We see their bond with each other. Two things that I would kind of throw out just to sort of start here as well with the release from bondage things is sort of, two things, one which is pretty obvious, and one which I think is less obvious, but really kind of jumped out at me this past time that I was reading it, when I had this question in mind. The sort of obvious thing is that it doesn't take long to notice that in this story called Release from Bondage, we get a whole bunch of really obvious prison and prison breaks, you know, going on in this chapter, right? I mean, we have in this first half of the chapter, we had what, like three or four prison breaks? So people are getting released from bondage all over the place. So certainly we see that as a kind of a, I mean, you start off with even Beren's leaving Tara Nufuin at the beginning, I mean, under tragic circumstances and stuff, when he's now literally the only member of the House of Beor left up there. But anyway, even that becomes for him a kind of prison, and he leaves there. But then you've got Luthien escaping twice from prison, you know, once by her hair, as we've talked about, and once by Huon. And then you've got, of course, Finrod and Beren being held in prison, and Luthien and Huon come and rescue them. So even just in this first half, we have people being literally released from bondage all over the place. But that's, as I said, the sort of simple thing. The more complicated thing, which I thought was really cool, if you turn to page 167 in the trade paperback edition, this is the moment of Beren and Luthien's meeting, when he has just stumbled into Doriath, and he sees her for the first time, or right after he sees her for the first time, the second full paragraph. But she vanished from his sight, and he became dumb, as one that is bound under a spell. And he strayed long in the woods, wild and wary as a beast, seeking for her. In his heart he called her Tenuviel, that signifies nightingale, daughter of twilight, in the grey elven tongue, for he knew no other name for her. And he saw her afar as leaves in the winds of autumn, and in winter as a star upon a hill, but a chain was upon his limbs. We have two very interesting, bondage terms there in that paragraph. That is, he is as one that is bound under a spell, and that is later on described as being as a chain that is upon his limbs. And this spell of silence falls from him later on, when he is freed from the initial bondage of the spell that she casts on him, down at the bottom of that page, and wandering in mind, he groped as one that is stricken with sudden blindness and seeks with hands to grasp the vanished light. Thus he began the payment of anguish for the fate that was laid on him, and in his fate Luthien was caught, and being immortal, she shared his mortality, and being free, received his chain, and her anguish was greater than any other of the Aldalie has known. So there again, Beren's chain. Now, this seems to be a different kind of chain, not the chain of the spell, not the chain that's placed upon his limbs when he is enchanted at the sight of her. Now mortality seems to be being described as a chain, which again is really interesting. As with many of the things we're going to talk about tonight, we're not going to be resolving anything finally, I think, until, you know, next time when we talk about the end of the story. But I think there's some really cool stuff there. Obviously, the idea of bondage and escape from bondage has many different senses and sort of operates on many different levels in this story. Dave?
You stole my point. I was going to point out the thing about. I thought it was interesting that the title of the chapter is "Escape from" or the title of the song "Lay of Lathian" is "Release from Bondage," but that they point out that in falling in love with Baron, Luthien actually becomes bound by a chain. And I'm wondering, let's push on that meaning of bondage for a moment. Mortality. It would seem that that's what they're talking about there, but maybe I'm wrong. Let's push on that. Do they escape from that bondage? If that's a chain, if mortality is a chain, they don't actually escape from that. They both die indeed, as they say of Luthien later in the chapter.
Yeah. Now, of course, because, see, the mortality thing is easy to turn around. I mean, who is chained? Are mortals or elves chained? Elves are the ones who are chained to Arda, right? Their spirits can't leave Arda until the end of time. So it's mortals who are free. You know, we've alluded several times to that passage in the Aina Windowe that talks about the unusual freedom of men. And this certainly, even if not thinking in terms of free will, they certainly are freer in this sense. When they die, they go the elves know not whither. They leave. They're free. Free of Arda, anyway, wherever it is that they go.
Maybe this is one of those cases where we should appeal to the fact that this is an elf document. So the elves, in recounting the story, might portray mortality as a chain or as bondage, but that's not necessarily the true. That's not necessarily the essential nature of mortality. Bondage. Maybe it is actually more freedom than what the elves have.
Yeah, and I mean, and I'm not necessarily saying that, you know, mortality is the real freedom and immortality is the real bondage, but just that one can look at it from either direction. Certainly, from within the scope of their lives, it's the humans who seem to be chained, you know, that they are continually tied, you know, to time in this way, that the elves aren't tied to time at all, but, you know, their relationship with it is so different and they are so constrained, by the limitations that are placed on their activities, that certainly constrained at the very least is something that seems to describe them. So I'm not saying that the elves are totally have it wrong, but yeah, I do think that the story of Baron and Luthien here in the Silmarillion is one of the places where I think we can see some of the kind of elf bias most clearly, especially at the very beginning and the very end, of the story. And I want to come back and look especially at the ending when we get there, from this perspective too next time. Cause I do, so basically at least one of the points to sort of put it simply or, you know, inconclusively is, I think there's clearly some irony also. Not only is the title operating on different levels, but there's definitely some irony involved. Mike, what were you going
to
say?
If we read bondage to mean obligation, I think there might be another meaning there, because in this chapter there are so many oaths and obligations floating around, and in at least a couple of cases there's a character who successfully discharges his responsibility under an obligation or an oath that he's earlier made. So in that sense there's a release from bondage, if you view bondage in that sense of the word.
Right, right. I mean, I think that there are definitely different senses in which we can understand that, and it's pretty clear, you know, from the very literal ways to some much more complicated ways. As I said, I definitely want to return to this topic probably at the very end when we look at the very ending, because the sort of the levels of release and of bondage that are gonna be happening at the end of this story, I think are going to get really complicated. So we're sort of doing nothing but anticipating at this point, really. But it's definitely worth looking at. Let's see, John, would you be able to talk a little bit about, you wanted to talk about other versions of the title, which I think is really interesting. Are you able to talk about that?
What I was curious with, because I haven't gone back to the Book of Lost Tales recently, is I was curious if there had been other optional titles which Tolkien was originally considering for Release from Bondage. Because remember, like, with the Children of Húrin, he had, like, Narnirach Morgoth, the Tale of the Curse of Morgoth, instead of Narnihin Húrin. So I wondered if there were alternative versions, you know, out there, which could have different opinions portrayed in different titles.
That's a really good question, and unfortunately I don't have... this is one of the downsides of doing this seminar from my house, is that I don't have all my books with me, and most of my copies of The History of Middle-earth are in my office. I know that, let's see, I know in the Book of Lost Tales it wasn't called this initially, but I'm forgetting, and I don't want to say anything wrong. And of course, the thing with the Beren and Lúthien story is we get a version of this in the Lays of Beleriand as well. And I'm trying to remember how the title was introduced in that, and I would need to look that up. So, that's definitely an interesting thing to look at. And I'll see if I can, remember to look into that before next time and, get back to you guys on that. Yeah, The Tale of Tenuvio is what I thought, it was called.
Dave's jumping in because I have them in front of me and I'm looking through now. So in the, unless, I don't know if there's discussion of it, but in the Book of Lost Tales, it's referred to as the Tale of Tenuvial.
Yes.
And in the Lays of Beleriand, it looks like it really is just the Lay of Lathian.
Yeah. Okay. So that that's what I thought I was remembering, but I wanted to make sure that the Lay of Lathian comes from is there in the Ways of Beleriand version. The Ways of Beleriand version is just sort of explain this history a little bit. The Book of Lost Tales, those are the very first versions of the Silmarillion stories. Some of those date back to the 19-teens, you know, when he was still in World War I and stuff. So the Book of Lost Tales are the very earliest stuff. So these are the first versions of all of these stories that we get. And the major stories, the Fall of Gondolin, Beren and Lúthien, Túrin, Túrinbar, all this stuff dates back from that time. And, two of the stories, well, in intention three, in practice two, basically the next step, he was going to write, a full, like, epic poetic version of them. So he started, an epic poetic version of Beren and Lúthien and wrote quite a bit of it. And the volume three of the History of Middle-earth series, which is called The Lays of Beleriand, is basically, what exists of the long, rhyming poem that he was, writing of Beren and Lúthien, and then the long alliterative verse poem that he was writing of Túrin Túrinbar. So that's what we have there in The Lays of Beleriand. And then later on, when he's reworking the Quenta Silmarillion material, he comes back to it again, but those are the two sort of initial versions of it. Well, let's move on to, let's say we'll definitely come back more to the title, because again, I think that even more than most of the stories, it's been pretty unusual so far that we've been given a title. Normally, when we have a reference to, for instance, you'll remember, in the Kinslaying and stuff, we were told that a fuller version of the story of the Kinslaying was told in the song that Maglor made. And we were told the title of it, but we don't hear it. I mean, it was alluded to because we were told, you know, if you want to hear the whole story, you should go to this poem. This is an occasion where we're being told that what we're getting is here is a summary of this poem. So the title is being really brought to our attention. So I think that's obviously pretty important. Any comments that people want to make on Barahir, on the time in the time up in Tower Nufuin with Barahir and Beren and his band of, like, what's the opposite of merry men? I mean, his band of, like, grim and dreary men up in Tower Nufuin. Thoughts about Gorlim the Unhappy, who's one of my favorite. Has one of my favorite names. And of course, I think here, by unhappy, he's not just meaning like Gorlim, the guy who was pretty sad a lot of the time, though clearly he was Gorlim who was kind of sad a lot of the time, because, you know, we learn about his wife that he's pretty sure is dead and then finds out is definitely dead. But of course, you know, also I think, Tolkien is using the older sense of that word unhappy, which means unfortunate, unlucky as well. That was the original, you know, meaning of happy. And so I think in that context, it's very interesting, that he is called unhappy, not like the jerk who betrayed everybody, but the unfortunate. Elizabeth, go ahead.
I have a question, actually, about the dream that Beren has that warns him about Gorlim's betrayal. And we see lots of dreams like this, the kind of the premonitions and the dreams of forewarning. And I just wonder what the origin of these dreams are. Do they come from, I guess, internally of the person, or are they dreams that come from the Valar, or do they come from an external source?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And of the two of them, the second one seems to be most clear. That is, you know, we have first. Well, I guess it's. I'm thinking really. It's one dream. It's sort of the two parts of the one dream. Worth reading. But as he slept benighted in the forest, he dreamed that carrion birds sat thick as leaves upon bare trees beside a mere, and blood dripped from their beaks. Then Beren was aware in his dream of a form that came to him across the water, and it was a wraith of Gorlim, and it spoke to him, declaring his treachery and death, and bade him make haste to warn his father. So we're told that this is a wraith of Gorlim. And so I have to, that word wraith, it does sound like it's actually the spirit of Gorlim who is coming to him there. However, does this mean that Gorlim somehow has the power to, you know, cause prophetic dreams and stuff? I don't think so. And I think it's a little bit suggestive. Where have we seen dreams come from? Who's the one who sends dreams? So far, we've got like a 100% significant, portentous, meaningful, and prophetic dreams being sent by Olmo, right? And I think it's a little bit conspicuous that a form came to him across the water. There seems to be water involved in this dream. So, you know, maybe not definitive, but I'm tempted in that direction.
Just a follow-up question to that, yeah. And not to get way off topic here, because I know we have a lot to cover, but we see so many dreams in Lord of the Rings, too. You know, Faramir has dreams, and Frodo has dreams. Could we attribute those dreams as well to the Valar, or where would those come from, do you think?
And I do, basically. I mean, there is some language in some places that... that is, and I'm thinking here especially of the Valaquenta in the part where Olorin is discussed, that is Gandalf, or the spirit which will later on become Gandalf, as being associated with the dream, with dreams and the sending of good dreams. But there it seems to be more, you know, fair visions and all that stuff. But there it seems to be more like encouragement to the spirit and stuff like that, rather than like you are being sent to prophetic message, or, you know, a dream like seek for the sword that is broken in Imladris it dwells. That kind of dream, doesn't that sound kind of Olmo-ish? You know, I don't know. A voice speaks from the west in the dream, you know, when he hears it. Yeah, I kind of have to think this is the Valar. And I think it's really interesting the way that it's, I think it's really interesting the way that Tolkien frames it. Tolkien is so restrained. I would never be able to restrain myself. If I had this whole mythology worked out like this behind the story when I was writing The Lord of the Rings, there's no way I could possibly resist, like, and now let me indulge myself in 15 pages of exposition to tell you where this came from. And, but he doesn't do that. Basically, he tells it from within the frame of the people. Faramir himself doesn't understand. Boromir is the one who from whom we hear about it, of course, and Boromir certainly doesn't understand. He has less book learning and knows less lore than Faramir does. And even Faramir's knowledge is imperfect. But anyway, they don't really know. They don't really know the Valar. They know of the Valar. The Gondorians that we meet allude to the Valar, you know, like when the Mumak is bearing down on them, you know, the Valar, turn them aside. But still, we don't know really how much they know. But yeah, I mean, I don't see where else it comes from. And it's exactly the way there's this clear pattern. Chris, you just mentioned in the text chat that, you know, maybe it's from Ilúvatar himself. It's possible, but we do see the Valar doing this lots of times. So, you know, maybe. Mike, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, just back to Gorlim. What I wrote down when I was reading this was, it was interesting that this longer chapter, which is about, you know, sort of the central love story that Tolkien is telling between Beren and Lúthien, the springboard to the action and the launch pad to the entire tale is this love story between Gorlim and his wife that is cut short. And that sort of resonated for me, that the sort of energy that gets the larger story going that he wants to tell is this other love story that we don't get to hear about, but it's cut off too soon. And then the fact that Gorlim is in mourning is then manipulated by Sauron, and then we're off on the tale of Beren and Lúthien.
Yeah, no, I think that is an excellent observation, and it does serve in that way as a really clear frame for the story. And again, we get within the context of their love and their relationship with each other, we get again release from bondage language. So if we go back to that language that Sauron and Gorlim uses, Gorlim answered that, you know, when Sauron demands his price for the treachery, Gorlim says that he should find Ilanel again and with her be set free. Then Sauron smiled, saying, "That is a small price, so shall it surely be." And then he says, "I will grant thy prayer. Go to Ilanel and be set free of my service." So he releases him from bondage through death, through mortality again. And again, that sort of piteous complaint, that desire to be reunited with his beloved, and for the two of them to be set free. That's what, as you say, Mike, launches this story and serves as a kind of, it seems to cheapen it to call it a foil to Beren and Luthien's relationship, but certainly a preparation, a setup. We see two people who are bound together, and whose bond to each other transcends the bond of death. That is, he is still devoted to her. He is still connected to her, even after she has died, and ultimately, you know, himself only through death is reunited with her, but that itself seems to be a kind of freedom. So anyway, just again, as another thing to kind of put into the release from bondage pot as well there, I think Gorlim gives us some promptings there. Yeah, Jordan, what are you thinking?
I love in a very, like, twisted way that Gorlim says, if you give her to me and set us free, then I'll tell you whatever you want to know. And Sauron says, well, yeah, of course I'll do that. She's dead, now you are too. Like, it's very sort of dark on my part, but I love that moment of the book where Sauron says, yeah, of course, your wish.
Yeah, yeah. I shall reunite you. And see, I think there is also beyond of certainly the darkness of Sauron's motivations and the way in which he is mocking Gorlim there. There's also a kind of irony that is, this is true in ways that Sauron either doesn't know about or doesn't care about. It seems from what we see later on in this story, that he is in fact reuniting Gorlim and Ilanel. That this is not just mockery, that in some sense, it is almost as if, you know, he does end up granting them a boon. You know, and I'm not saying that in Tolkien's world, like, you know, two thumbs up to death at all times, death is always awesome, but I do think that we can see, and we'll get back to this more when we talk about Turin Turambar, plenty of death to go around there, but I think that, yeah, there is that irony, in what he's saying. He is being intentionally ironic that he's sort of twisting this around on Gorlim, but I'm not sure that in the end, at least to some extent, the last laugh isn't on Sauron there, actually. Anyway, yeah, lots of really good stuff on on Gorlim that I think we could definitely talk about for a while. But let's move on to the next section, to the big meeting between Baron and Luthien. Let's see, Brandon, are you audio ready now? So you wanted to talk about the echoes with Thingol and Melian?
Oh yeah, I mean it's just this will happen again with Arwen and Strider, but we know that there's this type of and just being awestruck by her beauty and that aesthetic arrest of that moment. And just having that aesthetic, just transfixation. I mean, in some cases, in Thingol's case, he's transfixed for a number of years. Ages, it says, right? And and I just thought with that, at least Thingol would be a little more appreciative of where Baron's coming from. And maybe Melian is more appreciative about sort of a woman condescending herself to a man. And just the kind of just awestruck nature of the man just saying, oh my god, how could something so beautiful ever happen? It's kind of like a fulfillment of the song and so on and so forth. I don't know. I just see it as a type that will happen again and we'll hear echoes of again later on down the road. But yeah, I don't know. I thought it was pretty cool.
No, definitely. And I... yeah, and I certainly agree that there is... The parallels, the clear parallels, and we didn't even need the Nightingale connection. Remember, nightingales follow Melian around, and Tunuviel means nightingale. We didn't even need that connection, hopefully, to be reminded of, you know, when Thingol was spellbound by Melian's beauty, as you say, for years and years. And so this kind of, I think, gives us some insight into what we're talking about when, with that language of, you know, the spell that is laid on him and that, you know, his being bound by the spell and his chain there, the first time that it refers to that. Because we should be remembering Thingol and him being completely, as you say, transfixed for many years. But at the same time, he apparently, Thingol himself, obviously has sort of forgotten this, and there's no question that there's a pretty sharp irony there, in his getting all indignant about people marrying up, you know, and oh, you don't deserve her. Well, you know, who's talking here? So yeah, let's see. Let's go in. It's hard because there's so much I think to say about the meeting between Baron and Luthien, but in some ways, I don't know. I don't even know what to say about it. That is about the moment when they actually encounter each other. It's one of the most iconic moments in all of Tolkien's fiction, I think I would say. Of course, there's a way in which this is a lesser echo of the Thingol and Melian version. That is, this is like not only a generation down the road, but sort of scaled down. Instead of the great elf lord falling in love with the goddess, you have, you know, the great mortal man falling in love with the elf princess. But at the same time, there's also a sense in which the Thingol and Melian instance is really just an anticipation of this, and that this is really at the core of stuff. Mike?
We can also say that Baron is stooped over in gray, where he's been sort of washed out of all color, and Luthien is better than standing upright. She is dancing, and she's described in the most spectacular colors. So their first meeting is sort of described in these sort of opposites in terms of being bent over and lost, you know, lost of all color versus full of life, upright, dancing, and described in the most spectacular colors.
Yes, but also shadows too. Isn't that interesting? Luthien has black hair, and she's described as being, you know, the maiden of the twilight, and she's associated with shadows. And that's one of the things that I find really fascinating about her, is that you'd think that she would just be radiant and full of light. I mean, that's sort of the sense you get, and sometimes she is described that way. But she's not just radiant, she's also shadowy, and especially given the fact that Baron has just come through this journey of darkness, And instead of finding the release from that, from the horror of his journey, and the evil in which he's been, you know, by which he's been confined, instead of finding the release in that in something which is just completely opposite, you know, in something that is just like, you know, bright and radiant and cheerful. Instead, it's, you know, it basically, he finds this darkness which is beautiful, this shadow which is beautiful, this twilight which is beautiful. Remember, the elves are always associated with the twilight. You know, they are the children of the stars. They are, you know, that the people who were alive during the, you know, during the starlight, before the rising of the sun and moon, you know, that's sort of the home of the elves. So, but anyway, I find that really interesting that you don't just get the light and darkness thing going on there. Brandon, what are you thinking?
No, I'm just thinking that this sorrow thing is just deeper than what it, you know, this kind of, there's two things I want to bring up. One thing is, one of the things is, we're told, if we skip ahead a bit, I don't want to spoil anything, but that the day Turin Turambar was born, Beren met Luthien. And it's kind of like this counteraction story, as opposed to kind of that, how death is resolved in that story, as opposed to how death is resolved in this story. It seems that this beauty that Luthien has, it can't be just like gold beauty, like kind of Galadriel, elvish, white, you know, just kind of what we think of Varda, this kind of blonde beauty, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's dark, you know, and it's sorrowful. So it's almost like, and I was just rereading The Return of the King, and I got to the part with Faramir and arrow in her eyes, and it's sorrow in the beauty that pierces, it's sorrow in her beauty that just pierces his heart and makes him fall in love with her. And there's even echoes of that type of relationship and even that small relationship, you know? I just think it's everywhere you look, you see Tolkien trying to resolve this kind of suffering world with beauty, that beauty is sorrow, and from sorrow, you know, you can gain wisdom from that through Gandalf. I don't know.
Yeah,
it just seems like a very, very like interesting topic. Yeah,
right. Exactly. That the cleansing of his grief, the cleansing of his pain, the cleansing of his sorrow is not happiness and joy and, you know, rainbows and butterflies. The cleansing of his suffering is twilight, is seeing as you say, Brandon, sorrow and beauty mixed, seeing the beauty in it. I mean, the fact that he sees this woman, he doesn't know who she is, he doesn't know anything about her. All that he knows is that he is, you know, bound under a spell by the sight of her, and he's straying around like a beast seeking for her in the woods, and in his heart he calls her daughter of twilight. And that I think is just pretty amazing. Dave?
I just wanted to bring up Aragorn and Arwen. They have a discussion in the appendix of the Return of the King, where Aragorn says something about essentially when they sort of choose to be together, they turn from both the shadow and the twilight. And I was wondering how that connects to things here. I always understood that to mean that shadow obviously is evil, fear of death, things like that. And twilight, of course, is sort of the elvish stuff. They turn from the desire for immortality. And I wonder how that connects here, if at all.
Yeah, that is a really good point. Because they're clearly, twilight, when you're talking about the elves, the word twilight begins to mean something different in the Third Age than it means in the First Age. In the First Age, we're very far from the twilight of the elves in Middle-earth. We're not quite in the morning, but, you know, we're still, I don't know, maybe 11 a.m. in the day of the elves in Middle-earth. by the time we get to the end of the Third Age, we're told that now comes the Dominion of Men, and the elves are fading. So the elves themselves, in their time in Middle-earth, are in their twilight. And that's, of course, what Arwen is turning away from. She's turning away from the Shadow, which is, you know, Sauron and evil. They're going to resist the Shadow, but she's not going to simply go into the twilight, which she could do. And it's kind of interesting, you know, with her, she could pass into the West, which would seem like escaping from the darkness into the light. But even that, in a sense, with her, seems to be kind of lumped into this idea of twilight. Here, twilight is not talking about, you know, the fading of the elves or sort of the destiny of the elven people, but just, yeah, darkness, that state of, I mean, here, the way that it seems to be, what it seems to evoke in this passage to me seems to be that, you know, the status of twilight as neither dark nor light. It is not bright day, but it's not darkness. It's the time in between, the time which is both, the time which is, you know, thinking of the, you know, the phrase, the mingling of the lights. Well, this is, the twilight here is the mingling of light and darkness. And it's there, in that twilight, in that mingling, that, that Baron essentially, finds healing. And I think that's pretty amazing. But I know that several of you have been excited to get to the big meeting with the in-laws, which doesn't go particularly well for Baron. You know, talk about, being nervous about going home to meet her dad. Matt, you had made the suggestion earlier on this week that that we read some of this. We do a little dramatic reading of the part of the passage, the conflict between Thingol and Baron. I think we should do that. You guys ready? Dave and Laura in this, and Matt, let us begin. Then Thingol looked upon Baron in scorn and anger, but Melian was silent. Then said the king,
"Who are you that come hither as a thief, and unbidden dare to approach my throne?"
But Baron, being filled with dread, for the splendor of Menegroth and the majesty of Thingol were very great, answered nothing. Therefore Luthien spoke, and said,
"He is Baron, son of Barahir, lord of men, mighty foe of Morgoth, the tale of whose deeds has become a song even among the elves."
Then said Thingol,
"Let Baron speak. What would you hear, unhappy mortal? And for what cause have you left your own land to enter this, which is forbidden to such as you? Can you show reason why my power should not be laid on you in heavy punishment for your insolence and folly?"
Then Baron, looking up, beheld the eyes of Luthien, and his glance went also to the face of Melian, and it seemed to him that words were put into his mouth. Fear left him, and the pride of the eldest house of men returned to him, and he said,
"My fate, O king, led me hither, through perils such as few even of the elves would dare, and here I have found what I sought not indeed, but finding I would possess forever. For it is above all gold and silver, and beyond all jewels, neither rock nor steel, nor the fires of Morgoth, nor all the powers of the elf kingdoms shall keep me from the treasure that I desire, for Luthien, your daughter, is the fairest of all the children of the world."
Then silence fell upon the hall, for those that stood there were astounded and afraid, and they thought that Baron would be slain. But Thingol spoke slowly, saying,
"Death have you earned with these words, and death you should find suddenly, had I not sworn an oath in haste, of which I repent, base-born mortal, who in the realm of Morgoth has learnt to creep in secret as his spies and thralls."
Then Baron answered,
"Death you could give me earned or unearned, but the names I will not take from you of base-born, nor spy, nor thrall. By the ring of Felagund that he gave to Barahir, my father, on the battlefield of the north, my house has not earned such names from any elf, be he king or no."
All right, excellent. So what do you guys think? Thoughts on the confrontation between Baron and Thingol here? Let's see, Matt, let's start with the point that you made, which I think is a really interesting point, about Thingol's derogatory use of mortal here. I mean, there's twice in that passage when he seems to use the word mortal as an insult all by itself. What are your thoughts about that? Laura?
Yeah, I was struck by the irony of Thingol's attitude towards Baron, considering who he married. You know, he certainly looked very far above himself with Melian, Of course, he didn't have a father-in-law to contend with at that point. But, you know, we don't see too much of his character before the Noldor came back to Middle-earth. But, you know, he seems awfully full of pride, and he seems progressively to be getting more and more sort of uppity, sort of, you know, putting himself, you know, in charge of everybody else, and, you know, not even, in this point, not even listening to Melian, which, you know, I mean, come on, she's a Maiar, you know, you should be listening to her. I just thought it was ironic the way he treats Beren, considering, you know, he was in sort of the same position himself.
Yeah, and I think that this is something that's actually really interesting to think about. One thing that we can see in previous chapters when we've gotten some of the interaction between Thingol and Melian has been basically him... It seems that not only has he forgotten that he married up at least as much as Beren is looking to marry up here, but almost like he's sort of forgotten... actually that he married up at all. He doesn't seem to be paying so much attention to Melian anymore. She, you know, she'll make prophecies. She prophesied this exactly. He is right now disregarding the prophecy that she made when he said, no man shall ever come to my realm. And she's like, yeah, actually, one of the children of Beor is in fact going to come, and my power will not be able to restrain him, for a fate greater than my power will be guiding him. You know, and she's not explicitly saying, and here he is. But obviously, Thingol did not pay a lick of attention to that. And we saw even in that chapter when we get that little conversation between Melian and Galadriel, when she's turning and, you know, when Melian turns to Galadriel and basically sort of makes comments on what happens, and we see a kind of division between them, between Melian and Thingol, and sort of the way that they look at things. And I think that... in this, I would be tempted to see the pride of Thingol in operation, basically, and to see certainly the way in which that pride is being manifested here in his conversation with Beren. But, Chris, go ahead.
Yeah, I had several things going through my head on the character, just the general character of Thingol. First of all, as far as his attitude towards men, I mean, he's had a little contact with... the Valar, by having gone to Valinor, plus he's married to a Maiar, he must have heard, somebody must have told him along the way that men are also the children of Iluvatar, and so it's just a kind of a total disregard for, his, you know, Eru's creations, their, you know, fellow children. And so it's like, in addition to the point you made about him forgetting that he married up, but also that his pride just kind of is overwhelming. He has no, apparently, whatever honor he had is gone now. He's got, he said that he would have broken the oath and killed Beren if there was any hope of him actually getting a Silmaril. He's got a wife that's really good at seeing the future, and he continues to ignore her, advice to, and keeps getting demonstrated as being wrong. I mean, if there's anyone in the whole story that is more illustrative of pride, more than Thingol, I don't know, I mean, Beanor perhaps, but I think, as far as pride goes, Thingol gives him a run for his money.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, as you said about his attitude towards men, it is kind of Feanorian. I mean, when we heard Feanor talk about the men before they were born, I mean, before when they were still to come, you know, in his whole, no other race shall oust us speech, you know, you see that same attitude of rivalry and you know, his being dismissive of them and everything. And we see Thingol where, you know, you've got again, in obvious contrast to Finrod, Thingol not even willing to think about it, not even willing to talk about it. As you say with Melian, my favorite line by Melian is, is afterwards when after you know he does it, Thingol does his thing, and she says okay. After you know he does it, Thingol does his thing, and she says, "O King, you know you have wrought cunning counsel," and basically she's not saying "I told you so," but she's saying, "I would have told you." You know, why are you, you know, for not by you, she said, shall Baron be slain, and far and free does his fate lead him in the end, yet is wound with yours. Take heed. You know, but he's not gonna take heed. Take heed. And like, I would have to, before you bound yourself, before you did any, you know, you said any of these stupid things, I could have told you. You know, and it, that's the place where before he lays the you know before he makes the doom of Doriath, but yes, it's right after that on page 168. O King, you have devised cunning counsel, but if my eyes have not lost their sight, again emphasizing you're not paying attention, I have sight, by the way, just in case you're curious. It is ill for you whether Baron fail in his errand. I don't even know why I'm prophesying right now. Nobody's listening to me. So yeah, I mean, but yeah, that's I think we can, this is the moment, I think, where we can see most sharply the kind, and I hate to say divide, because that's not quite the right word, but the kind of divide between Thingol and Melian.
Well, it kind of reminded me just for a brief moment of Celeborn and Galadriel, and Galadriel kind of, you know, smacking him down a little bit.
Yes.
As far as...
Yes, definitely. Definitely. He would be rash indeed who said that thing, right? Yes, yes. yep, yep. No, there's definitely... It's one of the problems with marrying up is that sometimes... that is, if you're going to marry up, then it's best to pay attention to your wife, as Thingol certainly ceases to do. Celeborn, at least, seems to take the prompting when Galadriel gives it to him. So that's good, anyway.
She's the one with the ring.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. No question who wears the ring in that marriage. yeah. Yeah. Jason.
Can you hear me?
I can.
Oh, I feel like just declaring victory and stopping right now after the last couple of weeks, but I'm trying to see things from Thingol's point of view a little bit here. I mean, playing devil's advocate. I mean, the guy must have some redeeming qualities if, you know, all these Teleri stayed in Beleriand and didn't cross the sea because they were waiting around on him. And here's this stranger walking out of nowhere saying, hey, I've violated all your laws and I want to marry your daughter, by the way. And so I could see how he might react to that somewhat negatively. And with the whole issue of him ignoring the parallel between Baron and himself with respect to marrying up, I mean, at least he can hang around with Melian for thousands of years, whereas Baron cannot do that for Luthien. And, you know, he may be thinking here, this guy's going to be around a few years, he's going to die, and then Luthien's going to be a widow forever. So, I mean, yeah, clearly the guy is flawed. He's prideful, and that leads him to a bad end ultimately. But I think there are some mitigating factors here we should keep in mind.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. And just because Baron and Luthien are parallel, in a sense, to him and Melian, doesn't, as you say, mean that their situations are the same and he should be recognizing that it's identical, because it isn't identical, and there are some important differences there, as you point out. And I would actually continue that devil's advocacy one step further to suggest, at least, some... look again at Baron's speech. Like, I'm sorry, this sounds sketchy to me. I mean, listen to this. My fate, O King, led me hither, through perils such as few even of the elves would dare. Okay, so we're boasting, but you know, all right, if you can deliver on the boast, like, it's not so bad. And here I have found what I sought not indeed, okay, but now wait for it, but finding I would possess forever. I would possess forever. Doesn't that set off any kind of warning bells here? For it is above all gold and silver and beyond all jewels. Okay, so it's better than jewels, but you were just talking about possessing it, and we've seen, you know, Mr. Capital P Pride himself and the possessiveness of jewels. Everybody who's really proud wants to possess stuff, like Melkor and Feanor. Is this a kind of a Feanorian moment by Baron here? What's up with that? And then, wait, it's worse. Neither rock, nor steel, nor the fires of Morgoth, nor all the powers of the elf kingdoms shall keep from me the treasure that I desire. Who does that sound like? Vowing to pursue with vengeance and hatred to the ends of the world, Vala, demon, elf, or man as yet unborn, or any creature, great or small, good or evil, that time should bring forth unto the end of days, whoso should hold or take or keep a Silmaril from their possession. It's not exactly the same as the Oath of Feanor, but darn if, I mean, that's, it sounds a little Feanorian to me. What do you guys think?
I agree.
Yeah, I don't want to be beating on Baron here. Baron is clearly a good guy, but that speech, Thingol's response to that speech is death you have earned with these words. You know, as you say, Jason, I'd have a hard time totally blaming him for that. Mike, what do you think about that?
Well, I don't know if I want to jump in right now and start talking about oaths because we're kind of touching on it. When I got to this point in the chapter, I was logging all of the different oaths that different characters were making and how they were all starting to sort of come into collision with each other. So if others have other comments just on this particular scene, I'll step away. But I do want to come back to that because I think you're touching on something that I found really interesting.
Yeah, and I was kind of thinking of this discussion of Baron's words here as a sort of transition into the larger conflicting oath issue that we're going to get into when we move to Nargothrond, which is next. So we won't go too far away from this, but more on Baron first, and then Mike, I'll come back to you for that. Dave?
Sorry, I'm with Mike. I want to jump in on oaths when we get
on oaths. Okay, no problem. Sorry. No problem. Chris, did you have something on Baron?
Oh, just a follow-up comment, really. I don't take back much of what I said about Thingol, but I think that a good point was made that Thingol may go a little bit overboard, but it is his daughter, and this guy shows up and declares that he's going to take her no matter what. So I guess I'll cut him some slack. again, I think he does kind of. I don't back off what I said about pride, but I have to concede that point.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's just the thing that of all of the Baron passage, the one that seems to me strangest is "shall keep from me the treasure that I desire." He makes it sound so unilateral. One could kind of wish that Baron's speech here were more like, but Luthien and I really love each other and we are bound to each other with love. Hey, surely, father-in-law, you can understand that. The binding of love, which comes across you all of a sudden when you're walking in the woods and transgresses, species barriers, like, you're with me on this. But that's not his approach. His approach is, my fate led me hither and I am awesomer than many elves are. And I desire, I would possess this treasure forever. And it's a really awesome treasure and nothing shall ever keep from me the treasure that I desire. That's
very Feanorish.
Yeah, it is very Feanorish. Now, I mean, but I think there are some differences. I mean, I don't want to go too far with that. I don't think this is Baron totally going off the cliff. But I do think that, we can see, and certainly, at the very least we can say about Baron is he's going to redeem himself pretty heartily later on, but pretty emphatically. But still, this is a moment. And remember, Baron, still, by the end of the first half, although he accomplishes a lot, I mean, his rescuing of the ring and his journey, we're told his journey through the Arid Gorgoroth, that is not the Mordor Arid Gorgoroth, but the other ones, he certainly is accomplishing stuff that nobody else accomplishes. So I'm not saying that he doesn't do anything, but he is certainly not gonna do anything yet for a while. He goes to Nargothrond and he gets help. He's done very little except sit in prison, You know, he's managed to get arrested and he's going to manage to sit in prison. But from this point, he's not going to do very much for a while. And I think it's interesting to see when Baron becomes a more active, player in this story. You know, I was alluding to earlier that, you know, that Rapunzel moment that Luthien has is sort of the moment when she becomes a really active player in this story. We'll see the moment when Baron becomes a more active player in this story, and that's later on, and I think it'll be important to remember this speech when we get there. Let's see. Laura, go ahead.
Yeah, I thought I'd come to the defense of Baron a little bit, and not just because I played Luthien in that little drama. Right before that speech of Baron, it says, "Then Baron looked up, beheld the eyes of Luthien, and his glance went also to the face of Melian, and it seemed to him that words were put into his mouth. Fear left him, and the pride of the eldest house of men returned to him." So these words, you know, are not exactly coming from what he was thinking of saying. I mean, he's so intimidated by Thingol. He can't say anything. And I kind of feel like if he had gone in and said, you know, "I love your daughter and I want to marry her," Thingol would have just laughed him right out of the cave. Mm-hmm. He would have said, you know, "Just get out of here." You know, he's speaking a language that these elf kings understand, and that's the language of this kind of oath. You know, this kind of over-the-top sort of speech about... you know, that maybe in a way is supposed to remind you of someone who wants a Silmaril. You know, it's not just love. It's also you know, possession or something beyond that, something that's going to last forever, that's permanent.
Yeah, yeah, and that's a really important reminder that words are being put in his mouth at this moment. He's not. This is not just him expressing his own opinion. But of course it does open the question, who's putting the words in his mouth right now? I mean, what happens right before he looks at Luthien, and he looks into Luthien's eyes and then Melian's face, and then words are put in his mouth. It seemed almost, before he starts talking, it sounds like Melian has inspired him to speak. Then when he says what he says, you know, it's a little bit less clear that it's the, you know, but I think it depends on what we mean by words, what we understand by words being put into his mouth. That is, I don't think that we are necessarily to understand that, you know, thoughts and sentiment, thoughts that he didn't think and sentiments that he didn't have are put into his mind, but rather the expression of his thoughts are given words. I'm just looking at the text here, noticing Jason. We've said the thing you were going to say. I would like to give Jason Jewell credit for those points. He was totally going to say that far better than I said it. Let's see, Jordan. You wanted to pitch into the great Baron battle here?
Yeah, I'm ready to be an apologist. So although Baron's sentiment that he speaks is this, like, "I will possess her and she will be mine," it is a mutual feeling, and he knows that going into it. It's not like he's, you know, going to be, is it, oh, now I can't think of the dark elf that Dave
Aeol, yeah,
portrayed 2 weeks ago. Aeol, yes. It's not like Aeol, and he's holding her against giant grandeur of a statement. It is also her belief as well.
Yeah, that's true. That's actually an interesting kind of contrast, and we talked about that a little bit at the time. That is, Aeol and Arathel being a kind of foil for Thingol and Melian, especially since it's the same piece of woodland that it happens in, that their meeting happens in. And so that, I think, is an interesting counterpoint to go back to. Certainly with Aeol, we get somebody who stakes a claim on a woman, you know, whom he has entrapped, I mean, literally entrapped in his home, and then later, and then marries, though again, we're not told it's entirely and utterly against her will, and that she was always unhappy, but anyway, he clearly is transgressing here, and then later on is speaking proudly and arrogantly to the sons of Feanor and even to Turgon about, you know, sort of what is his and his possessiveness. You know, "You shall not take what is mine." And that language, I think, sounds different here. And Jordan, you're right. At the very least, the fact that he started off the speech by looking into Luthien's eyes, you know, and there does seem to be, you know, he's not just speaking for himself. This is not, you know, sort of his awkward way of making a proposal to her. They already have an agreement and an understanding, and I think that it is necessary and important for us to keep that in mind, as we hear his words here. I want to move on to the oaths, but keep this passage in mind. I want to come back to this this speech by Baron when we get to what I really feel is his first really big moment within their love story, within their story together after he's set free. So we'll look at that next time. But on to Nargothrond and the complex oaths. And I know Mike and Dave wanted to talk about that. Mike, do you want to start off talking about those oaths?
Sure. What I'd like to do is I just sort of run down all of the oaths that I saw floating around in this chapter. But before I do, I was reminded of the last thing that Elrond says to the Fellowship of the Ring, to the Nine, before he lets them leave. He says, "All right, Frodo, you have a kind of an oath, but the rest of you, no oaths, because sometimes oaths go wrong." And Gimli says, "No oaths help to strengthen your heart." And right. Then Elrond says, "Well, no, an oath can also break your heart." And so here are the oaths that I caught. There's Beren's oath over his dead father, "I'm going to avenge your death." There's Thingol's oath to Luthien, "You got to promise me, don't hurt Beren." There's the oath of Beren to Thingol, I will get Luthien and keep her forever. Well, there's Thingol's request to Beren to get the Silmaril that triggers the oath of Feanor. Now we're on to Felagund has an oath that he owes to Barahir. There's the Caligorm proclaiming the oath outright after that. Then there's Felagund noting to his subjects that they're free to break their oaths that they owe to him since he's about to leave with Beren. And I think that was it as far as I got. But I just thought, seeing all of these competing oaths and then catching how Elrond in Fellowship of the Ring has this ambivalent attitude towards oaths, I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah. It is kind of fun in retrospect, Elrond being like, "You know, guys, I got to tell you, oaths, it often doesn't work out. Let's not go there." Definitely. It certainly is complicated. In the moment where our attention is really drawn to it, we see, you know, in the scene that we were just looking at, sort of two oaths almost going at loggerheads, or not exactly at loggerheads. What happens is Beren starts with his oath, which sounds kind of disturbingly like Feanor's oath, that, you know, Luthien is to Beren what the Silmarils are to Feanor, which is uncomfortable. And then essentially the oath that Thingol lays on Beren is essentially like a manipulation of that, of Beren's initial oath. "Oh, you say that you're not going to let anything keep you from the thing, the treasure that you desire to possess. Well, fine. Okay. Then surely doing such a small thing as getting a Silmaril won't get in your way." So it's not even necessarily an entirely new oath being placed upon Beren, but a very uncomfortable enactment of the oath that Beren has already made. Before I steal your thunder again, Dave, I better let you start talking. Go ahead.
I just wanted to point out that some of the oaths in this chapter seem like positive oaths. Like Felagund's oath, obviously on the surface, looks like a good oath. He took a sworn oath to aid the family of Barahir because Barahir saved his life, so his life's sort of forfeit anyway. And Thingol's oath, even though he regrets it, is a good oath. He swears an oath not to harm Beren, and yet these oaths end up roping them into a far greater, more powerful, more terrible oath, the oath of Feanor and the accompanying Curse of Mandos. And so, even when oaths are good, they can end up leading, leading to bad consequences. There's unforeseen consequences in the future. You can't predict what will come of the oath that you swear now, and maybe this is why later in the Lord of the Rings, Elrond's like, "We're not doing oaths, guys."
Right.
Who knows
right.
what will come of them?
Right. Exactly.
Who knows?
No, I mean,
maybe the oath of Fëanor's still around, working evil. Let's just stay away from oaths altogether.
right.
I think that's the really interesting and complicated thing about oaths. And actually, Chris is bringing up something that I was thinking too, that what you see in World War I and World War II are alliances leading to a domino effect in terms of war. And alliances on the surface seem great, like, you know, hey, we'll come and protect you if someone attacks you. But when you get this sort of complicated network-like structure of intermingling oaths and alliances, next thing you know, everyone's pulled into war, everyone's pulled into the Oath of Fëanor, and everyone ends up suffering the consequences of the Curse of Mandos and just sort of all the general evilness surrounding the Noldor. And so even good oaths can end up proving to be bad.
Yeah, yeah. And I would just to emphasize that point that you're saying, I love Finrod's final point about that. You know, his final statement where he talks about the Oath of Fëanor, and unfortunately, two of the Sons of Fëanor are here right now, and so this is gonna, I know this is gonna go badly, and he ends by saying, "Yet my own oath holds, and thus we are all ensnared." That idea of being ensnared, as you say, even by a good oath, the oath that he swore to Bar here was good. Though it also has an element of a rash promise in it. You know, I promise help in every need, that I will do, I will help him whatever the situation is. Perhaps maybe Finrod, you could have phrased that oath a little differently. But you know, I'm not sure that even if he had, he would still have said at this point, basically he could conceivably have been more cautious in his oath so that he wouldn't be completely bound to do now what he has to do now for Beren. But you know, had he just made a more cautious oath to Barahir, I'm not sure he doesn't do the same thing anyway. Because he's a good guy and Beren needs help.
So the lesson then is always include a loophole in your oath.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, it's the rash promise thing. Like when somebody comes to King Arthur and says, you know, promise that you'll give me whatever I ask you. And King Arthur always falls for this. You know, it's like, oh yes, I promise whatever you ask me later on, I will give you. And then it's always uncomfortable. And so to some extent, there's an element of that kind of a rash vow in Finrod's promise. But, you know, and he is kind of ensnared by it. But again, I do agree with you, Dave, that I don't think that it certainly doesn't make his pledge to Barahir a bad thing. Jason?
You know, with all this talk about oaths going bad, I can't remember. Has anybody thrown out a Jephtha parallel yet?
No, but you might as well. Yeah, I was thinking about that too.
Well, yeah, this is the story from the Book of Judges where Jephtha wins a big battle, and in gratitude, he swears an oath to offer up to God as a sacrifice the first thing that he sees when he gets home, or the first thing that comes out to meet him. And of course, he gets home and it's his daughter. And so you have this sort of ambiguous ending to the story where it says that he did as he had promised, but so you're left to infer, I guess, that he actually did sacrifice her after she was given a period of mourning for her virginity. But it's a great biblical parallel of an oath that was sworn with good intentions and as an expression of gratitude even, but then goes horribly wrong.
Yeah, horribly wrong, and that certainly does seem to be the moral of the story of Jephtha. That one of the things certainly that we see in the story of Jephtha and that we see in the story of Finrod is, again, you know, as Dave was saying, this inability to predict stuff. You know, you can't know what's going to happen. So anytime you say, I'm going to make a promise that I'm going to do this, you know, that this is, you know, well, you can't foresee what's going to happen. Which of course reminds me of Melian, the one who can foresee what's going to happen, but her husband isn't paying attention. Brandon?
You know, I don't know if it's so much the oath or the taking of an oath, which is a bad thing? Because taking oaths seem to me a very good thing. That is, that you're subserving, you're humbling yourself not to the oath and not to yourself and to your own ego. And like we have the Hippocratic Oath and, you know, we swear on different oaths, we agree on these different things. It's not the oath itself, it's the people taking the oath that's the problem. It's not the oath and the sort of transcendence there. It has nothing to do with it. The taking an oath isn't a bad thing. The people, how you go about swearing to the oath or your allegiance to the oath is the bad thing. So it's, again, it's people's decisions. It's not the oath itself, I don't think.
Well, I mean, I agree that certainly, obviously some people, you know, bad people take bad oaths and stuff. But I think that with both Finrod and the parallel that Jason suggested with Jephthah, we see a good person who, in what seems to be for good reasons, takes an oath which ends up ensnaring him. With Jephthah, ensnaring him into what seems a really bad, or at least certainly very tragic act, and with Finrod, ultimately to his own destruction. I think to his own destruction, but we'll get back to that next time. Mike?
How would we put in context Sam's oath to Frodo kind of early on in Fellowship of the Ring, where Sam kind of very privately promises never to leave Frodo? Is that an oath?
Well, it's interesting. It's to the elves that he makes it. It's to the elves of the House of Finrod. There are some Nargothrond refugees that Frodo and Sam and Pippin run into in the Shire there in the Fellowship of the Ring. And it's to them that Sam is talking when he makes that oath, if it's an oath, that semi-oath. Let's see, I'm trying to remember Sam's words. Sam says, you know, he quotes them and he says, you know, don't you leave him, they say. Like, they're encouraging Sam not to leave Frodo, and he proclaims his intention not to leave him. But I guess that could be taken as an oath. Of course, I also remember Faramir's words here, of course, that that he would have taken his words, that, you know, he wouldn't have picked it up if he found it by the highway, and he would have taken that as an oath, even though it wasn't solemnly sworn. So it does seem that there are promises like that. When you say something, when you declare that you're going to do something, you deliver on it. Thinking, by the way, of another person who is ensnared in an oath, would be Brego, the son of the King of Rohan, who at the christening feast of Meduseld, swears the oath to walk the paths of the dead and tries and dies, and he's the skeleton with the sword that they find when they go through the paths of the dead. Certainly another person who gets ensnared. But now there, I mean, he was drunk and made a rash oath, which he couldn't keep or couldn't survive keeping, but did keep it. Now Sam does say that he. I mean, Sam clearly thinks of it as a promise. Dave?
I was thinking maybe one difference between Sam's promise and the oaths that we see sworn time and again throughout the Silmarillion is humility and pride. I don't know if that's the difference between a good oath and a bad oath, or maybe the difference between a promise and an oath in general, but there does seem to be something qualitatively different between Sam's promise to never leave Frodo and somebody sort of rashly and sort of grandiosely promising, like, in any need, I will help your people. Here's my ring. Take this. Or,
yes,
or I will pursue the Silmarillions until the end of the world, no matter who gets them. Or I will do whatever it takes to win the hand of your daughter. And
right.
It seems to be a humility versus pride difference here, like we've hit on for like attitudes toward death and other things.
Yeah, and I think the biggest thing, and you're very right. And to me, the big difference there is the future. Those oaths involve the future and sort of make assumptions about the future. Under whatever circumstances, I won't let anything stand between, you know, me and the Silmarils. And we'll see in the end the final snare that the Oath of Feanor catches Maedhros and Maglor in. And you can see, like, there are a whole bunch of contingencies that they didn't anticipate when they made that oath and that they're going to get caught in. And the same thing with Beren's oath, as we can see, Thingol immediately catches him in that. And the same thing with Finrod's. At whatever point in the future, whatever help anyone in your line happens to need, I will give it. And that is how he is ensnared. In this moment. Whereas with Sam is already sticking to Frodo. He is already with Frodo and supporting him, and what his promise is, what his if he's swearing an oath, what his oath is to keep doing what he's doing. Like, I shall persevere in the task that I have already undertaken. And that's a totally different thing to do, a totally different thing to say than these kind of like, I'm gonna kind of presume that that I know how this is going to go in the future. It has to do with the future because it's about his intentions of how he's going to act, but it's not nearly the same thing. Chris?
I might be saying, just reiterating what you're saying, just a little bit nature, or a little bit different, but I guess it's the absolute nature of the way these oaths are worded. That, like you said, no matter what happens, no matter what extenuating circumstances, whether Finrod, the whole of Beleriand would have been much better off if Finrod hadn't have taken an oath. Maybe he could have just backed that down a little bit, so something a little less absolute. Nargothrond obviously would have been much better off if he'd have stayed there. The sons of Feanor probably couldn't have, did what they did, and maybe Turin wouldn't have done the things that he did, but again, getting back to the absolute nature of these oaths, you know, leading into looking into the future and assuming you know everything that's going to happen, that nothing's going to happen that's going to make you sorry that you made that promise or took the oath.
Right. And even with Finrod here, even assuming, as I said, I kind of assume that even if he had no oath and Beren shows, I mean, even if, you know, Barahir saves Finrod's life and Finrod doesn't swear this binding oath, and then Barahir's son Beren shows up and it tells him the story, oh yeah, you know, let me tell you about how Barahir, your friend, was hunted down and only I escaped and then I got screwed over by Thingol and now here's the situation I'm in. I gotta think Finrod wants to help him anyway, but what he doesn't have to do,
I agree,
is out himself to Kelgorm and Gurufin right there and be like, so, sons of Feanor, I'm going to go after a Silmaril now, if that's okay with you. I mean, he wouldn't have to do that. He wouldn't be ensnared in that way. His hands wouldn't be tied in the same way that they are tied. So I do think that's a pretty big difference. Okay. All right. So here's the story. It's getting pretty late now, and I don't want to start the fight between Finrod and Sauron until we can do it justice. I totally agree with the sentiments that have been raised by several of you that we should definitely read some of that poetry and we need to have some style time moments here, in thinking about, this song and this conflict. This is a big, it's one of the things that I always come back to. You know, when somebody asks me the question of how, when somebody wants to talk about how magic works in Tolkien's world, this moment is one of the ones that I always come back to. This fight between Finrod and Sauron. So let's start there next time, which means that we may end up doing 3 weeks on this chapter instead of two. So Dave will get his extra time, perhaps. But we'll see. I'm open to that. I think certainly if there's any if there's any chapter we're going to spend 3 weeks on, it'll be this one. I'm going to warn you in advance, I can't bear to spend 3 weeks on Tour and Tour and Bar. It's not going to happen. You know, we'll have to have, like, Suicide Watch by the end of that. But Baron and Luthien, we can totally spend 3 weeks on. So we'll see. We'll see what we do. We'll start with Finrod, and Sauron, and then get to Luthien and Huon, and then move forward to Melkor and the Silmaril and Karkaroth and everybody else. So let's end there for tonight. Thanks, everybody. Good talking to you guys again tonight, and I look forward to at least one more week of Baron and Luthien.
Two more weeks.
Two more weeks. I understand. All right. Good night, everybody.
I just have to laugh at Dave. That's too funny.
Thanks for listening, and Godspeed.